This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a nostalgic photo journey, an art exhibit showcasing works of a major collector, or a musical adventure, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. A decade's worth of portraits will take viewers down memory lane in the exhibit Louisiana Serial by visual artist Blake Boyd. Hundreds of Polaroid images capture faces of resilience in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Boyd was assisted by his wife, Jeanette Bone, and they are both here. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Diane.
This has been a passionate project for both of you. What was the inspiration for Louisiana Serial?
I started in a photo booth machine 30 years ago documenting people from Louisiana, the iconic people like Paul Prudhomme and the Neville brothers. I started off taking those portraits, and it was very difficult to get people into a photo booth machine. So I put the project aside until Katrina. And after Katrina, I guess everybody who was local became nostalgic of, you know, what was missing. A lot of people had moved away. So I thought of starting the project back. Photo booths had disappeared, but I had a Polaroid camera and went back to the original concept of documenting 100 kind of icons of Louisiana. It was much easier. I had a Polaroid so I could go to them. So I tried to make it look like the old photo booth pictures. And the other great advantage this time was I had a girlfriend who's now my wife helping me, Jeanette. She's been able to write letters, contact people, spend a lot of time behind the scenes for me to capture everybody I've had on my list and many more.
Now, when I hear Polaroid, I'm thinking, do they still make Polaroid film?
About a year after I started the project, Polaroid announced that it was going to discontinue production of all of its film. I was devastated. I had to convince Jeanette to go in with me. I had a credit card. She had a few credit cards. And we maxed out $25,000 worth of Polaroid Spectra film, which I was using. Had to buy a refrigerator to store it in, because at that point, the project had developed more to a epic documentary. You know, Katrina made a lot more icons than I originally had thought of. For instance, Brad Pitt came in and did the Make It Right rebuilding. Spike Lee did two separate documentaries.
David Simon with the Tremé.
And Harry Shearer did a documentary and a big advocate of New Orleans. So some of the icons that I've got are people, you know, that weren't on the list 30 years ago, but now became kind of iconic to us locals.
And these are people from all walks of life?
You know, I started off with the concept of getting like all the institutions like Mother's, Cafe Du Monde, Pat O'Brien's, the restaurants, Commander's Palace, Antoine's. We didn't have the BP tragedy when I started, but that made these people who lost their livelihoods, fishermen and shrimpers. So I went down to Grand Isle after that to include them. There's people like Jose Holmes Jr., who was shot on the Danziger. You know, I wanted to capture some of the tragedies that happened after Katrina. I personally had an M16 pulled on me by an OPD SWAT, and having a gun pulled on me made me want to go after people like Jose.
Tell us about the individual shots themselves. These are stark shots against a white background?
Basically, I don't want any props. I don't want hands in the photo. I just want a clinical documentation. It shows the humanity in each of these people. You know, it's just them.
How hard was it to get people to sit for those portraits?
A lot of people, it was easy. There's been some difficult ones. A difficult photo, and not because of him, but who he was Brad Pitt. Jeanette approached him at the groundbreaking for Make It Right. The handlers were saying, there's no way you're going to photograph him. And then when Brad came back and saw us, he was a gentleman. He posed for me, and he is very fascinated with the camera that I use. I use a Polaroid Macro 5, which was made for Denniston Forensics. It's an odd-looking camera. It's this big plastic box. Another difficult person, and this was because of him, was Bobby Jindal. Bobby turned me down, but I'm persistent. So
there are several other politicians that you included in the exhibit.
A lot of politicians and a lot of people's politics I don't agree with. I've got Edwin Edwards and David Duke.
There's no editorial to the series. There'll be no commentary other than just a glossary that helps explain who the people were. Definitely a portrait of Louisiana. We've been very fortunate. One of the art book publishers who's based in London really picked up on the project and embraces the idea of the Polaroid. He has encouraged us to publish a book, well, he's supporting us, obviously, of the 100 Louisiana icons, people that will be recognized through the media coverage following the hurricane, the BP disaster, the Baton Rouge floods, et cetera, et cetera. There will be amongst those the institutions represented, the first responders, chefs, local actors, local musicians, of course. These will make a fabulous book that we want to have organized and produced for the tricentennial of New Orleans next year.
So the project will live on beyond the exhibit.
Yes.
Now, the title, Louisiana Cereal, how did you come to that?
I called it cereal with an S. And soon after, I crossed out the S and made it cereal, like a breakfast cereal, to make it sound like a Louisiana gumbo, to make it more fun.
What are you hoping the legacy of this photographic journey will be?
You know, 50 years, 100 years, when we're all gone, I hope people look back and see the people I've got in this documentation and realize how special this place was, how special this time was.
It has become a contemporary time capsule, and we do need to conclude it. The Polaroid is deteriorating, and 10 years is a long time. That's why the tricentennial is a wonderful paragraph break or something for the project.
Hopefully I've left something for future generations.
Visual artist Blake Boyd and his wife, Jeanette Bone, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Blake Boyd's Louisiana Cereal is on view at Boyd Satellite Gallery, 440 Julia Street through September. More info online at louisianacereal.com. You can meet Blake and Jeanette Friday evening from 5:30 to 7:30 at Rocky and Carlos, 613 West St. Bernard Highway in Chalmette, as they celebrate the upcoming publication of their book, 100 Louisiana Icons. Pride of place usually means a prominent position of one thing in a group. A new exhibit of contemporary art at the New Orleans Museum of Art also highlights the pride of a group of 80 pieces on display. It's designed to show the collection of author Roger, who ran the influential gallery he opened in 1978. He recently donated his entire collection to the museum. Exhibit curator Katie Full spoke with WWNO's Eileen Fleming.
My name is Katie Full, and I'm the curator of Modern Contemporary Art at the New Orleans Museum of Art. What exactly is Pride of Place? So, you know, the exhibition's title came out of our attempt to really celebrate Arthur Rogers Gallery and his long-term support of both local and national artists.
Tell me about Arthur and his collection.
Sure. So Arthur has been, you know, one of the most prominent gallerists in New Orleans over the course of the last 40 years. He opened his gallery in the late 1970s and has been collecting art ever since. And so his collection really ranges in scope from work made from the 1970s to work just made in the last few months by some of the young artists on St. Claude Avenue.
And what is this very first image that we see here?
So this first work is by a terrific artist based in New York named Deborah Cass, who Arthur has worked with very closely over the course of many years. And she actually curated some very pivotal early shows at the gallery for him, for Arthur, and also showed her work at the gallery fairly frequently, especially in the 90s. And this piece is called Camouflage Self-Portrait. And she is an artist who is always kind of trying to take apart all of the power structures and all of the sort of preconceived ideas and stereotypes that we have about popular culture and popular imagery. And so in this work, she took the idea of Andy Warhol's famous portraits of Marilyn Monroe, Jackie Kennedy, all of these sort of, you know, female icons, and also Andy Warhol's own self-portraits, and transform them into portraits that take that same style, but instead show images of her, and that's actually a self-portrait of her right there, or other feminist icons and intellectuals. But Arthur was really one of the most pivotal voices in bringing contemporary art to the city, and really one of the first artists, and I think this is very important, to show the work of female artists, show the work of African-American artists, and also gay and lesbian artists, and I think really open up new perspectives and points of view and bring a new voices to the city of New Orleans.
Well, this is the opening room. I'm going to ask you to pick one of these pieces from a New Orleans artist.
Sure. Well, one of my favorite works in the show is this work by John Scott. John Scott is a very prominent New Orleans artist who works both in sculpture. He's famous for these large-scale kinetic sculptures as well as in printmaking. And this is a large woodblock that he used for his printmaking process. And so this is actually the literal printing block that he would have used to create the print. And John is such an interesting artist, and he works actually with very interesting and diverse media. He actually carves almost all of his large-scale woodblocks, which are larger than any I've ever seen any artist use, with different chainsaws and sort of these rigged things so that he can get a kind of very loose improvisational feel that sort of would be considered very akin to jazz. So he viewed his work as very performative and would use these sort of, you know, rips and rags of chainsaws and other materials to kind of get that sense of improvisation in jazz. And this piece itself is a work called Marianne, and it's actually based off of a portrait of Louis Armstrong's mother, who was a famous New Orleans madam.
And there in the next room, I recognize Mr. Warhol.
Yes.
Who's next to Mr. Warhol?
Next to that portrait of Andy Warhol is a work by Robert Gordy. We actually have an installation of his work in the Great Hall right now, and he's best known for these really vibrant works that are based off of African art and textiles, really vividly colored pattern pieces that sort of put these surreal figures in these hyper-colored and very vibrant worlds. And this work that Arthur has started is actually a very different kind of work that Gordy made in the 1980s. So Robert Gordy found out that he was HIV positive, and he was someone who Arthur very much supported. And Arthur, as a result of sort of the ways that HIV was impacting not just people nationally, but also people in New Orleans, Arthur actually did some very pivotal early programming and early exhibitions that tried to sort of shed light on that social issue. I think one of the other things that's very interesting and compelling about so many of the works that are in the exhibition is that Arthur was really continually pushing the envelope in terms of really introducing some very provocative subject matter, thinking about race and gender and class and power, and doing so, I think, in a way that was really attuned to the issues that were affecting the local community here in New Orleans.
That is so cute. Now, it's a running horse. It looks like a plastic horse, but somehow it's moving.
Yeah, so this is a work by the artist Lee Deergard, who's one of the artists I was referencing when I was talking about all of the young artists Arthur's collected from the St. Claude Galleries, which have, you know, really, she's part of a collective art gallery called The Front on St. Claude Avenue. And her work, she works in photography mostly, but also in video and installation and drawing. And this work is meant to kind of reflect on people's relationship with the environment and especially with animals. A lot of her work kind of focuses on the way that we connect with and understand animals and the sort of kinds of intelligences they have that are often very different than what we have as humans and that we can learn from. And so this is actually what she calls a stop motion animation of her favorite plastic childhood horse. She is a big equestrian and a longtime horse lover, and she created this video that basically, you know, over the course of a series of images that are sort of strung together, makes it look as if her plastic horse is running against this backdrop of this dreamy sky. So this is kind of, you know, I think a young girl's imagination of her plastic horse run amok in many ways, where you really can get this sort of...
It's alive.
Vision. Yeah, exactly, this vision of what, you know, the imagination might do with such a thing as a young kid. And you'll see that it actually, she even has the plastic horse shown there for reference. And this has been a hit in the exhibition among both adults and kids who are running around the galleries galloping and things like that. And you'll hear in the background the sound of snoring, which is actually the sound of her horse that she has now snoring.
This is the sound of the sleeping horse.
And as she says, the hardest part about this was not creating the stop motion video. It was trying to sneak up on a sleeping horse, which I liked a lot.
Yeah. Katie Fole, exhibitor of Pride of Place. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. This has been a lot of fun.
Pride of Place runs through September 3rd at the New Orleans Museum of Art. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. New Orleans songbird Debbie Davis and pianist Josh Paxton have a new CD, a live recording, Vices and Virtues. It marks their solo debut as a duo after 20 years of collaboration. Debbie Davis and Josh Paxton, welcome.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks, Diane.
I can only imagine your excitement as your live album, Vices and Virtues, is a reality. Where was it recorded and how did it come to be?
Up on the third floor of the old U.S. Mint, down on Decatur and Esplanade, right on the edge of the French Quarter, is a beautiful performance and rehearsal and recording space that's owned by the United States Parks Department, and it's part of the National Jazz Historical Park. A lot of people have performed there, but not all of them realize that they actually have recording facilities that are part of the performance room. So we brought in Mark Bingham to help set up some microphones and a couple extra preamps and oversee the recording. But what you hear is basically what that facility is capable of.
Now, you guys have worked together for the past 20 years. How did you meet?
There's actually a discrepancy there. Debbie claims we met through Lee Harris, a wonderful singer who we both worked with. But
Lil
before
Queenie?
That, yeah,
that's right.
Lil Queenie.
Uh-huh.
But before that, you apparently don't remember this, but I met you through Matt, through your husband.
I think Matt was on the gig with Queenie.
That may have been so.
See, I think all the convergences are there. It's just, you know, holes in our memory, which are considerable.
I'll
absolutely admit to that.
So, Debbie, how did a girl from Jersey wind up in New Orleans?
I came down here when a friend of mine was moving cross-country. He was moving to Colorado, and since New Orleans was only about 700 miles out of the way, we decided to come down here. And we didn't know we were coming down during Jazz Fest until the day before we left. And while I was at the Jazz Fest, the second weekend, I walked by the Economy Hall tent, and I heard Tim Laughlin playing, who's now a good friend of mine, whom I didn't know at the time. And we went in to hear him play, and there was an upright bass player standing at the back of the stage. And I turned to my friend, and I said, "That one. He will be mine. Oh, yes, he will be mine." And Matt, I've been married for 19 years this September. So there you are.
This is Matt Perrine?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. You grew up in a musical family.
That's right.
I think your parents were opera singers?
They were. They still are. They teach primarily now, but I spent most of my early childhood traveling with them.
Was there any doubt that you would sing?
Yeah, I think I thought I was going to be a dramatic actress. But then I had a bad knee accident that took me out as a dancer. And to fill in the time, I started singing with bands locally. And the hook got put in my cheek and I got yanked into the boat. That was the end of it.
It's incredible. Josh, are you a native New Orleanian?
No, I grew up in Cincinnati. I came to New Orleans for grad school at this very campus, in fact. And got my degree, and by the time I did, I had fallen in love with the city, and I was making a living playing, so I stayed, and I've pretty much been here ever since.
So what can we look forward to on the new CD? What are some of your favorites?
There's an Irving Berlin song that we do called What'll I Do that I love. I think it's possibly one of the saddest songs ever written, definitely in the top five. It's so plain and so open in its sadness. You don't really have to do anything but sing it accurately and get out of its way.
What'll I do when you are far away and I'm so blue? What'll I do?
We played it through once and I went, oh my God, that's a beautiful song. We have to keep doing that.
Yeah.
You've done some covers for Fats Waller and also the Beatles?
The Beatles songs are both Paul McCartney songs.
In fact, that came about through the Paul McCartney concert that happened. That was
right.
How we started doing both of those, wasn't it?
It was definitely how we started doing Lady Madonna.
Yeah.
Because it's such a piano-centric tune.
And the other is When I'm 64?
That's right.
And what about the Fats Waller tune?
You know, that's a tune that that Debbie suggested we start doing, and I was a little bit hesitant because I was familiar with the tune, of course, but it was one that I had never really figured out what to do with as a pianist. You know, I played it and never really been happy with what I'd done with it. And she'd call it on a gig and I'd be like, really? Do we have to do that one? She'd be like, yes. And but through doing that, I eventually came to figure out something that seemed to work, and now it's one of my favorite tunes in the book.
And that tune is?
Oh, Jitterbug Waltz.
And it's a song that a lot of people don't realize that there are lyrics to, mostly because there are a lot of them and they are hard to sing.
My bad. I was thinking it was Lulu's Back in Town.
You know what? There is actually a theory that Fats Waller wrote Lulu's Back in Town and sold it to the people who take credit for it, because it sounds a great deal like several other songs that he wrote. And Fats was famous for sitting down at a restaurant with no money in his pocket, or sitting down at a bar with nothing to pay with. And he would eat and drink all day, and then when it came time to pay the bill, he'd say, oh, well, I can't really do that. Would it be all right if I wrote you a song instead? And more times than not, people said, yeah, all right, fine, and then put their names on it. So there are a lot of songs out there floating around that Fats Waller could absolutely have written that don't have his name on it. And that one, there's more than one academic theory that supports the fact that he had written it. He pretty much wrote everything before 1930, right? Can we just...
Yeah.
Him and Hoagy Carmichael, everybody else was just playing scales.
And the title of the recording, the CD, Vices and Virtues, where did that come from?
Actually, it was inspired by what ended up being the cover photo. It was just a shot that Zach Smith happened to get of a bottle of Jameson's that I had happened to bring along to the gig, like you do.
Thankfully, like you do.
Sitting on a table next to the piano. And those two things inspired the phrase Vices and Virtues. And my original idea was something like songs to inspire your vices and virtues with, or something like
right,
that.
Right, but I
which
couldn't fit that
shortened
on the spine of the CD.
Right.
What would you say you're most proud of?
The fact that we went in there and in 90 minutes got 83 minutes of music.
Mm-hmm. That's incredible.
Yeah. I think it's the lightning in the bottle thing. It'll never happen again.
Vocalist Debbie Davis and pianist Josh Paxton, thanks.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, Debbie.
More info on Vices and Virtues is available online at DebbieDavisMusic.com. That's our show for this week. Support for Inside the Arts comes from the Hellas Foundation. Our program is a production of WWNO and is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.